Andrea Bernstein sitting in for Brian Lehrer today on WNYC. There are no summer hours for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. She's in India today as part of a 12-day around-the-world trip, having visited Turkey and Greece, where she made headlines by recognizing Libyan rebels, chastising Turkey's record on free speech, and praising Greece's debt reduction efforts. She's in India today, kicking off a series of meetings to discuss Afghanistan and Pakistan. Then she's off to Bali in Indonesia for an Asian regional forum, in which a North Korean representative will also attend, one of the rare appearances for that country in any diplomatic talks anywhere. Finally, she wraps up the trip in Hong Kong and mainland China. China did not send a representative to last week's talks on Libya and Turkey, but officials have said that global events will be the topic of conversation and the Arab Spring will likely come up. And you thought you had a busy week. Joining me now to go step by step through this trip is Gideon Rose. He's the editor of Foreign Affairs magazine and author of How Wars End, Why We Always Fight the Last Battle. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So this is a major trip with stops across the world from Greece to China. Before we jump in, what is the unifying theme for her visits this time around?
I think the unifying theme really is trying to hold everything together. You have a situation in which many aspects of the world are in trouble in various different issue areas in different regions. You also have a situation in which the United States government is basically brought to a standstill by a whole variety of domestic political insanities connected to the debt ceiling. And as you said, you don't get summer hours at the State Department, and the world goes on. And so the responsible members of the executive branch have to essentially keep doing their jobs and trying to ensure that government goes on, that foreign policy goes on, and that the world doesn't blow up over much and doesn't slide into disaster. And that's basically what this trip is about.
Trying to hold everything together sounds like sort of the underlying theme of the Obama administration at this point. Listeners, our phones are open for your calls for Gideon Rose. He's the editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. If you have questions or comments about Secretary of State Clinton's 12-day trip, and she is giving you a lot of fodder for questions or comments, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. As always, you can leave a comment on the Brian Lehrer Show page at WNYC.org. So let's talk about Turkey and Greece. They made plenty of news, first by recognizing the TNC, the Transitional National Council, the opposition in Libya, as the legitimate governing authority of Libya. For months, the Obama administration has been saying the leadership of Colonel Gaddafi has lost legitimacy, so let's start there. But here was Secretary of State Clinton speaking in Istanbul.
We still have to work through various legal issues, but we expect this step on recognition will enable the TNC to access additional sources of funding.
So like everything diplomatic, this is sort of delivered in an entirely kind of deadpan manner. But this was a sort of a representative big shift, right? Tell us, what is the Transitional National Council and what do Clinton's remarks mean here?
Well, these are the first. I'll start with small favors. They're talking with Turkey and Greece, but for once, at least, you're not talking about Turkey and Greece. So they're not fighting, which is nice and good. There are other times and other trips when this region would be about the South Balkans. So it's nice to know that this is not the issue now. The issue with regard to Libya is that the Obama administration, in conjunction with a bunch of other allies in Europe, essentially has decided to support the rebel side in a civil war in Libya. And they first did so on purely humanitarian grounds, with the idea of a no-fly zone protecting civilians in the eastern parts of Libya and elsewhere from reprisals should the Gaddafi government manage to win the war and carry out retribution. But not surprisingly, that limited and partial and humanitarian mission has expanded into essentially a Game of Thrones-like battle about who will rule Libya. And after several months, the Obama administration has followed the inexorable logic of its original position and decided to cast its lot with the rebels. And so this was an announcement that we are formally recognizing the rebel political arm, the TNC, as the new government or the official legitimate government of Libya. We're in effect switching our recognition from Gaddafi's government to the rebels. But all the details remain to be filled in later.
You know, this is a shift for her, isn't it? I mean, you know, at the beginning of this sort of, or even before foreign troops got involved in the Libyan action, there was a lot of discussion about who are the rebels and, you know, is this going to be another Afghanistan 1980s where we're putting our lot with some rebels that, you know, turn out to be the bad guys that are after us?
I think that's true, but you also have to remember that this is not just about the rebels, but also about Gaddafi. Look, I think that this is clearly not a strategically driven policy. As in so many other places, the administration is essentially reacting to events and making decisions and then observing what the situation is after it's made them and making some other ones. So they might have been content to let Gaddafi stay if he had made some concessions or been willing to walk away. They might have been content to have some kind of negotiated arrangement in which his government remained, but he walked away for asylum in some ways. But after none of that has been able to be worked out, they finally sort of soured on Gaddafi fully, in the same way that they've ultimately soured on the Assad regime in Syria, and have moved, in effect, to the rebels, not so much because they love the rebels or because they're confident in the rebels' political capabilities or ultimate orientation, but simply because you have only two options, the rebels and Gaddafi, and you no longer think Gaddafi is legit, and you're de facto backing the rebels, so you might as well move forward and help them in a more thorough, ongoing way.
But how do we know, and we're going to be talking about the last Harry Potter installment later this hour, so how do we know that these, you know, to sort of use a little bit of Potteries, that the TNC is not really the bad guys, or another set of bad guys?
Well, you don't. First of all, there are very few good guys in the world out there, especially in the developing world, or at least very few good guys with real power or chances of power. So you're talking about lesser shades of bad guys. And what you're hoping, essentially, is that by recognizing them and by making them, in effect, dependent on you for continued aid and being willing to accept support and all this, you now have levers over them. And so you can essentially control their behavior. And so even if they prove to have some bad instincts, hopefully you're thinking that you'll be able to keep those in check.
Now, when Clinton says she hopes that this step is going to bring more funding to the opposition, I mean, you know, hope sounds, I know it was the, you know, campaign slogan of Obama, but nevertheless, it sounds a little kind of wishy-washy. And, you know, I'm wondering what is behind that? And does that, you know, signify that, in fact, you know, there's some arm twisting going on? Or is it really just a question of she hopes this works out?
No, I think what it is a kind of placeholder term. It's not, it would be nice if this actually led to funding. It's essentially, we would like this to lead to funding. We are confident that it will eventually, but there are all sorts of procedural and legal and other deals and details that we need to work out first before we can actually transfer money. So, for example, there are sanctions on Libya. There are assets that the existing or previous Libyan government, the Gaddafi government, has that are frozen. And it turns out that just because Washington or the White House says, we now like the rebels, that doesn't mean that legally you can disperse those frozen funds, that you can allow money to go even though there are sanctions. So there are a whole variety of legal details. And so we haven't heard anything about how those are going to be overcome or changed or tweaked. And I think that her hope comment was a sort of placeholder for we are now going to work on the details so that we can figure out a way to allow this announcement to lead to more aid going to the rebels, particularly also the disbursement of frozen funds that are currently attributed to the Gaddafi government.
Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer. My guest is Gideon Rose, the editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. We're talking about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's 12-day trip around the world, or at least from the, I guess, the sort of Near East to the Far East. But let's talk a little bit more sort of about, you know, world feeling about the Libyan action. European representatives were in Turkey for the Libya talks, but China was missing, as were Russia and South Africa. And Brazil and India sent what they call observers, but no representatives. So is there a fear that, or is there, you know, is it actually happening that attention to Libya and on the Libyan issue has stalled and support is lukewarm? And sort of what does this mean for the potential success of a Libyan intervention?
You know, everybody has their own troubles these days. Everybody has their own interests. And the further away you get from Libya, the less people actually are seized with that above all, especially since it seems not to be an immediate crisis right now. So, and you have a situation right now in which the world is a much more disorderly, messy place in which people don't necessarily jump to do the bidding of the U.S. or others. And so I find it totally unsurprising that there isn't a massive groundswell of support for the operation. You have countries like China, which have always been suspicious of humanitarian intervention, and nobody likes the idea that, gee, a bunch of countries can get together and suddenly decide to support the rebels and delegitimize the existing government of a country. And so it's not surprising that it's there. I don't think there was a huge amount of major support for the operation in the beginning. There seemed to be because there was an immediate crisis, but that was only because people were told it would be very easy to solve and wouldn't cost much. And now that it's gone on and costs more and is more difficult, people have naturally turned their attention elsewhere and moved on. And the people who are involved are kind of stuck with it.
Easy to solve and won't cost much.
Well, you know, that's the initial steps always
right,
are.
Always, right? But let's talk about Syria, because Clinton has been criticized for, you know, what sort of seemed like a kind of contradictory set of feelings about the Arab Spring events. You know, and with Mubarak, she was criticized for being a little slow to push for him to step down. And now with Syria, which really, really does have the world's attention. When you leave the United States, it's sort of the lead story on CNN International, what's happening on the Syrian-Turkish border. What, if anything, is Clinton doing on this trip to address the Syria issue, and where is that going?
You know, the Syria issue is fascinating because it's a crucial country for a variety of reasons. It's crucial to the geopolitics of the region at the highest level. It's been a junior partner in an alliance with Iran as sort of it's also danced with the United States occasionally in terms of negotiations on the peace process and elsewhere. But the Obama administration with Secretary Clinton as at state has tried to sort of entice Syria to switch sides, to jump to us and away from Iran. And they were very reluctant to go too far in criticizing the Assad regime because they didn't want to foreclose the possibility of a strategic shift by Assad to break links with Iran, or at least distance himself from Iran and move more towards a constructive engagement with the U.S. But after a while, they realized that's just not going to happen. And they also realized that they were taking a lot of heat for how aggressively nasty the regime was being in suppressing its domestic opposition. And so they finally moved themselves, or were moved into a more oppositional approach. They abandoned the regime, but they still have no new policy. The old policy was try to engage Assad. They now realize that policy doesn't work, but they don't have a new one in its place. And they don't really want to topple Assad in a second, because Syria is this weird ethnic tinderbox with a minority government and a minority regime. And if it blows, all sorts of other ramifications throughout the Middle East might be the consequence. So everyone is treating it very tenderly, and nobody wants to get involved militarily. So their policy right now is to hope that the situation will get better one way or the other, but with no actual concrete plans for bringing that about.
So should we be watching for anything with regards to Syria, or is this just something where literally the foreign policy is cross your fingers?
You know, I think we should be watching for developments in Syria rather than developments from the outside. As in so many places in the Arab Spring, the key developments are going to occur on the ground. Is there enough of a momentum by the forces opposing the regime to keep moving forward? Will suppression succeed? Okay. In Saudi, the government had enough control so it never really got off the ground. In Bahrain, the government was able to suppress the protests brutally but effectively. In Egypt, the government either couldn't or wouldn't do enough, and so the rebels won, although then what happens next is still unclear. Same thing in Tunisia. In Syria, it's still in play. In Libya, it looked like the rebels were going to win, and then it looked like Gaddafi was going to win, and we intervened to stabilize the situation and put a finger on the scale for the rebels. But in Syria, it's still in play. And as in elsewhere in the region, the local parties, the suffering dissidents, the mass of the Syrian population will have to ultimately decide this, whether they are going to ultimately give their support to the government or to the rebels. The outsiders aren't going to decide the Syrians' fate.
So what does that mean? Does that mean that, you know, U.S. can do nothing but stand by and hope? Or are there things that the U.S. government is doing behind the scenes that, you know, we're just not seeing?
They're doing some things behind the scenes, and they're doing some things up front. They're doing some things with regard to aid. They're doing some things with regard to sanctioning. They're doing some things with regard to expressing support. I mean, there was a reason why the U.S. embassy was targeted by a mob the other week. It's because we indicated our support for the rebels in certain respects. But there's not the United States isn't in a position to command the political destiny of every country around the world, and Syria is one of those that is a very dicey, complicated, intricate situation in which, yes, the local developments are going to determine the fate of Syria, not U.S. policy.
All right, let's talk about Greece. Mm-hmm. As negotiations are continuing in the U.S. over the debt ceiling, Clinton took some time in Greece to praise austerity measures there. Here she is speaking in Athens over the weekend.
The United States strongly supports the Papandreou's government's determination to make the necessary reforms to put Greece back on sound financial footing and to make Greece more competitive economically.
So, strong medicine for Greece. How does this reflect on the discussions in Washington right now?
Well, it's really hysterical because basically everybody knows what should be done in every country, except that it's much easier to say that about somebody else's country than it is about your own, because the domestic political class in each country knows its own immovability and, you know, fratricidal warfare and so forth. So we can tell Greece what to do, but the Greeks can tell us what to do, but the Greeks have a hard time getting their own act in order, just like we have a hard time getting our act in order. So here you have a situation in which a lot of governments have debt, a lot of governments need to grow, and a lot of governments also, you know, need to take constructive action to both get around the immediate crisis and deal with the longer-term crisis, right? That's the basic issue. You've got a short-term crisis in terms of a recession and unemployment and so forth. You also have a long-term crisis in terms of debt and public spending and so forth. Sides of government. And so the question is, how do you do both at the same time? And the austerity is both necessary but very politically painful. So Clinton was praising, like, sounding like almost
like
a Republican,
also, not
praising
just,
Greece.
Right, not just politically painful, but actually painful.
Absolutely. So Obama was sounding like the House, Clinton was sounding like the House Republicans, praising Greece for doing the kinds of things the House Republicans would like done in America. And I'm sure that the Greeks wouldn't mind if the United States did that, but it's very difficult for each government to do the same thing itself. And she was carefully staying away from the broader question of sort of Greece's relations with Europe and whether they're going to be bailed out and what the European countries are going to do, which is a difficult aspect of that situation as well.
Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer. My guest is Gideon Rose, the editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. We're talking about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's 12-day trip from the Near East to the Far East, but continuing around the world in 80 days. India. Now, Clinton is in India nearly a week after bombs in Mumbai killed 19 people. Terrorism will likely be on the agenda, although no groups have come forward in connection with the attacks last week. So where does India sort of come in on international counterterrorism discussions and operations?
Well, it's fascinating. You know, for years, the United States' challenge with India was to try to detach India from its obsession with its local regional context, to try to get the Indians and Pakistanis not to focus obsessively on each other and instead deal with their local problems and economic problems and broader global issues they'd want. We wanted, in effect, to educate the Indians to take the broad perspective of a major rising power, and they have largely done that. And so in some ways, this terrorism is doubly unfortunate, both because it's actually unfortunate and it's horrible as terrorism, but it also, in effect, is tempting to suck them back into a Pakistan-centric, regional-centric mindset, rather than the kinds of things the United States would really like to work with India on, which is economic partnership, global issues, helping with Afghanistan, and more generally sort of dealing with India as the major rising power that it is, a wonderful democracy, a thriving, massive part of the world, and a growing partner of the United States across the board in a whole lot of ways. That's the bigger picture, but she's going to have to deal, Secretary Clinton, with the local kind of terrorism issues. And frankly, the Indians are very happy with the United States' decision to be frostier to Pakistan, and will encourage that, and they will try and push the United States to be even tougher on Pakistan. And Clinton will sort of try to say, yes, we agree, but distance themselves because they don't want to give India everything India wants with regard to Pakistan, because we feel like we have a need to keep up a relationship with Pakistan as well. So the idea is basically India and Pakistan always see their own relations as a zero-sum game, unfortunately, and we want to have positive-sum relationships with both parties, and it's kind of a difficult thing to do.
Does the sort of recent or do the recent U.S. tensions with Pakistan, I mean, how does the Secretary of State's visit to India, her discussions with India, sort of affect that whole equation?
Well, the Indians will be trying to, in effect, say, we told you, see, you should be the ones dealing with us, and you can't trust those guys, and we've been telling you this all along, and this is only confirmation of it, and now you see we're all victims of Pakistani intransigence and radicalism and so forth. So we're your true friends in the region. And there's an element of that that's absolutely correct, which is why we have a much stronger relationship with India than we do with Pakistan, on a whole variety of reasons and ways. But the United States will want to make those calls for itself because it fears that India is not entirely rational when it comes to Pakistan, just like it knows that Pakistan is not entirely rational when it comes to India. So we want to be able to treat our relations with each of those countries separately and independently and not get caught into their own dysfunctional dynamic.
Well, we haven't been able to get through all of the countries of Hillary Clinton's trip. You can go there. I don't know if we can talk about all of them. But, you know, she's said on several occasions that she's not interested in serving another term as Secretary of State. How would you rate her service thus far? You know, what kind of job do you think she's doing?
I think she's doing a fine job. Frankly, I'd be very happy with her to continue. I mean, this is, do I think she so far has been one of the great Secretaries of State in American history? No, I don't think so. But do I think she has been a better than average Secretary of State? Absolutely. And I think that she's done a good job. She's smart. She's hardworking. She's competent. She's responsible. She's trying to be a constructive player on a whole variety of major issues. And the world and American foreign policy have done better for her efforts than they would have without them. And so I think that that's, you know, far more than the vast majority of government officials and certainly the vast majority of politicians more generally can say for themselves. And I think, you know, I will be sad when she moves on.
Although I don't know if that's much of a slogan. She was a better-than-average Secretary of State.
You know, these days, you know, just like common sense is not very common, sometimes the government, and you can see this in the debt crisis talks, is a little bit like the inverse of Garrison Keillor's Lake Wobegon. Everybody in government seems below average rather than above average. And, you know, to have somebody who's a responsible, hardworking professional, I think that Hillary Clinton has done quite a good job as Secretary of State, and she should be proud of what she's done, and I hope she continues to do it.
All right. Well, better than average, you know, may not be what you want if you're
quite
used to being the A student. Thanks so much. My guest has been Gideon Rose. He's the editor of Foreign Affairs magazine and the author of How Wars End, Why We Always Fight the Last Battle. Coming up next, we'll talk about women's soccer after Japan's surprising win over the U.S. yesterday. I'm Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC.